Of the temple, and the pig snouts, and the terrible pig's eyes, and the stench of pig's blood. Arise the flower of your face, the ancient hieroglyphic of a Hebrew letter, spelling the laughter of victory out of the darkness of the Middle Ages and the ghettos of the world. It is not your own rushing down the darkness of man's struggles. It anguishes out of darkness of suicides, of slaughters we cannot name, and angelic and with tears commemorates all suffering and looks down from all stars and all crosses.
Traitor, you are bested. All earth, all flowers, all space and rivers condemn you, and wait for us. An open green valleys and ways, an opening of rivers take us down. All hands draw you in. All shouts call you forth. The corn runs to greet you, and the wheat honors your children. Moundy, yeasty, perpetual morning bread. To us you belong and sing. Corn you have sunk into the nation's fertile earth. Corn you have risen green in the spring. Contain the seed of the lost. Contain the springs that are gone. Contain the children not born. The cry of the dead.
We germinate in darkness and in light. All death descends into the seed, and all entombed rise in us.
And in the private banner, the garden of our time, in the long and short years of our harvest, how lovely the rising of the faces of Martha, Nikki, Francie, signature of our hope, signed in the earth and air, against all traitors, against all oppression, these are the hands touching, these are the faces shining in green, risen in green in all spring.
Signature and hope of our time. all the poverty in the hole in which we find ourselves.
All power from the collective and from which we come. The only man or woman mattering takes that path. Who has seen the rising, always knows what is green
and tipped
and suddenly appearing green, red petals in the poisonous air. Germinal, abundant, million foliated, we wave green fingers, full palms
to each other.
The time is spring. The child is here. Corn knee-high by 4th of July. Sugar in the gourd and honey in the barn. Our earth is so happy that we are all born. This is a battle tossed
in sea with a message.
A red sea in the yellow field. A message to the living. Run, run, be nimble and be quick to all your creations, red and black kernel. Run, run, all creations in your hands. Let us all run to the light.
We are proud to present Regina Frankfeld.
Before going on with what I'm going to say, first I want to thank you very, very much for the song that happened. And I also want to tell you what it means to sit up here and to hear you sing such songs as Joe Hill and Union Maze and so on. Because, of course, those are the things that you don't hear while you're in prison, and those are the things that you are very, very hungry for. Speaking of, and I want to return the greeting that you gave me, but I want to return it not just in my own name. I want to return it in the names of all those who are with me here, even if they're not standing here. The men who are still serving in the various prisons of the United States, those who first went in, and among them, of course, is your own Carl Moses. And it's in his name and the name of his co-prisoners, co-political prisoners, that I really and truly want to greet you and tell you again that one of us only is standing here, and all of us, however, are standing here together. I'd like to tell you a little bit about myself, not very much, so that you can get some sort of a picture of what it means when you go in, what it is that you leave behind you. Because that which I left, the way I went in, is true of all political prisoners. When I went to prison, I was convicted together with five others. And among the five in Maryland was my husband. So that when we went to prison, we both went. He went to Atlanta and I went to Austin. He is serving 5 years. I have already served 2 years. And when we went in, we left behind us two children, a girl of 9 and a boy who was at that time 14. And that was how we went in. And during the time that we were in prison, he served in one jail and I served in another. And our children traveled between the two prisons. One visit was to their mother in Alderson. The next visit was to their father in Atlanta. So for almost 2 years, they traveled between the two prisons. And I'd like to tell you, and not only were the children separated from their mother and father, not only were they orphaned by the Smith Act, but they were also separated even from each other. Because one child lived in New Jersey, the other child lived in New York. And that was how we went in. An entire family served time, just as in the case of every political prisoner. Their whole family served time. Not only did the men and women serve time, but their children served time with them, even though they are physically behind bars. Now, I want to tell you something very briefly about prison itself. The sole aim, of course, when you are sent into prison, is to fight. That is the way, that is the means which is taken to silence your voice, to make it impossible for you to speak. And in that sense, prison is effective, because you cannot speak. No matter what you see, no matter what you know of, no matter what ideas you have, no matter what the issues are, you are silent. So for these years, say Gene Dennis, say Johnny Gates, say Carl Winters, have been silent because they're behind bars. And that was the aim in putting them behind bars, to silence their voices. But I'd like to tell you also something in a personal sense of what prison is like. There never dawns a new day. There is no new day in prison, no matter where you are, whether you are serving in Orison, you are serving in Leavenworth, or in Atlanta, or in Lewisburg, there is no new day. It's only the same day, which comes day after day after day. It's one long day which is broken by the night, but that's all. Because for all the time that you're in, you do the same thing every single day, and it never varies. No matter what you have to do, no matter what your family situation is, no matter how worried or concerned you are, the day repeats itself day after day, and it never is there a sense that it is a new day. It is always the same day. And then there is the prison night. And a night in prison is never quiet. There is no such thing as a rest, as sleep in prison. You may sleep for some hours, but there is no quiet. Because the prison night is broken. It is broken by the guards who make the rounds. It is broken here and there by the sound of a truck which rumbles through the ground. It is broken by the fact that an officer will come through the night and check you to make sure you're there. And it is broken by the sound of the people themselves, the sound of the other prisoners. And in the course of the night, you will hear a cry. You will hear somebody moaning in their sleep. You will hear the whole restless sense of what it means to be in prison. There's always this restlessness that pervades the whole prison. And that was true in all of them. I want you to think for a moment of what it is in Atlanta and in Leavenworth. Now, refer to Leavenworth because Carl Winters is there. Because there is no privacy. It's eight men to a cell. No, they are never alone, under constant surveillance. So there, the prison night is even more true than it was in Alderson, where I was. Because there, the sleep is not only broken by the guard coming around, but by the very fact that he is under surveillance all the time, day and night, physically. So that is your day and that is your night in prison. You work during the day. In Alderson, we work 40 hours. We work 40 hours a week. Now, 40 hours a week doesn't sound like much, because on the outside, you work 40 hours is an ordinary working week when you can even win. But in prison, you work 40 hours under the most terrific tension, because you work under the threat that if you don't work correctly, you will lose your day. And they can take days away from you every month and add them to your prison sentence. So that's one thing. You work under that threat. Then you work on the kind of work that you do perpetuates only the prison system. There is nothing about it that has any connection with the world outside. It is all prison work. You can be working on maintenance, that is cleaning the buildings. You can be working on a paint group, that means painting the outside of the buildings and painting the rooms. You can be working in food service, or then you prepare the food for the other inmates and for the officers. You can be working in an office, and then you keep the records for the prison. But all of it serves the prison. And the whole approach is that prisoners have no rights, only privileges, which can be taken away. It's a privilege to eat. It's a privilege to sleep. It's a privilege to wear a prison dress. It's a privilege to be able to write home. It is a privilege to have a visit from your family. And the slightest violation of any rule means that the privileges are taken away. So that you have no rights. You have only privileges, which can be taken away from you. And yet I can stand up here and tell you that political prisoners who go in behind bars not only survive the whole prison setup, but they grow in the process. Their voices may be silent for the period that they are in, but while they are in, their eyes are on the day when they will come out and what they will be able to do then. And in the course of the time that they spend behind bars, they transfer their whole sphere of activity to a new arena. Because we are very, very conscious that when we go to prison, that particular person where we are serving may be our special 8 feet of ground, but that it is related to the entire struggle of men and women throughout the world, and particularly in our own country. The battle against war and the battle against fascism. And we know this is our particular, let's say, trench, but it is not a trench all by itself. It is part of a vast battlefield of a struggle for peace and the struggle for democracy. And that is the reason that we go into prison, knowing that because our voices were raised, because we were men and women of conviction, because we stood by those convictions, and that's the reason we went in. But we also know that there are worse things than going to prison. We know that there is such a thing as a self-created prison, a prison that people build for themselves. And you may not physically be able to see the bars, but the bars are there. And that people have built for themselves, made for themselves, a prison that they are not getting out of. The prison of being afraid to speak and afraid to come out. And this self-created prison is far worse than the prison that men and women choose rather than be silent. So we go into prison with the consciousness, with the knowledge that we're political prisoners. And we go in there as the result of a conscious choice which we have made to link our particular individual fate and destiny with the great, tremendous destiny of all men and women for peace and for democracy. So that we take inward. But during the time that we spend in prison, we get tremendous help. And I'd like to tell you the help that I got, and which I know all of the political prisoners have received from you. When we go into prison, during all the 20 months that I spent there, every single month I received from the Smithack Families Committee a check for $12. And that check was to buy commissary. I was able to take the $12 and buy fruit, buy candy, buy cookies, buy soap, buy toothpaste, and so on. So that $12 made it possible for me to supplement the prison diet. But it was more than that, because it was a greeting. Every time that check came, it was just as though every one of you and all the people throughout the country who were contributing to the Smithack family was saying more than hello, but saying to me, we're here. So though I may have been very lonely, and I was, because after all, we're made of flesh and blood, and we are lonely for our children, and we are lonely for our husbands. Although I was very lonely, I was never alone, because all of you were there, and all of you were helping. But that isn't all that you did. It was your contributions that made it possible for my children to come to see me, made it possible for them to come to Alderson to see their mother, made it possible for them to go to Atlanta to see their father. And so in spite of the fact that the aim in sending a mother and father to prison was to shatter a family, exactly the opposite took place. As a result of what you did in contributing to the Smithack family, that aim was completely and totally defeated. And our family, in the course of the years, was able to build, to grow, and to even come closer together. My children were able to see that I was well. They were able to see that my husband was well. We were able to watch them grow. when they came, and we were able to transcend the bars of two prisons and grow the unity of our family even closer together than when we went in. So the aim being to shatter a family, to send a mother and father to prison, and to leave two children orphans, was destroyed because our children were able to grow, and we were able to grow with them. So that was a second result of your contributions to the Family Committee. And there was a third thing. It was the Smith Act Committee, the Smith Act families, rather, that bought my subscription to the Times and made it possible for me to have a newspaper. And without that newspaper, I would have been lost, because that was my lifeline. That was what I read from cover to cover. And you learn a new way of reading a newspaper in prison. You haven't got the Daily Worker. You haven't got the Sunday Worker. You can't read PA. All you can read is the bourgeois press. So you learn to read it, and you learn to gather out of it every little bit of news that has to do with the progressive movement. But you also are able to see the various trends in the country. So that also is made possible by your contributions to the Families Committee. And now I'd like to tell you the meaning of the greeting cards that you send. You know how often you're asked to send cards, Mother's Day cards, Christmas cards, birthday cards and so on. Well, to tell you just one little story, I had come up for parole, and of course I was denied parole. When the officer called me down to give me that slip, exactly on my birthday, it happened to be my birthday, it was an accident, and she hands me this slip, and all it says is denied. But I knew she had cards. I hadn't seen them, but I knew she had them. So I asked to see them, because Helen had once told me that Carl was able to look at his cards even if he wasn't able to have them. But at any rate, she let me look at the cards, and there they were. Greetings from all over the country, from little bits of towns that I can't even find on a map, from people, of course, whom I don't know. Cards that you could see that they had carefully picked out and which had the most beautiful messages. And I sat in that prison room with in the one hand that slip saying denied and in the other hand this treasure of greetings from all of you. And believe me, I could take that denied. Take it, as they say in prison, standing on my head. Because of the warmth, the affection, the love, and the concern that was mirrored in the card. And when I finally left Overton, I had them pack up every single card. My Christmas cards, my birthday cards, my Mother's Day cards, my Thanksgiving cards in a huge box. And when they told me I'd have to pay $6.42 at a mail home, I told him, don't worry, don't mail them, I'll carry them. So I said, well, it's a big box. I said, don't worry, I don't care how big it is, I'll carry it. And so I left Overton carrying my car. And when I came home, the very first morning I was home, my kids and I sat on the floor and we read the cards. And there were cards not only from every single state in the United States, but from many, many countries in Europe. And I'd like you to think for one moment of what it would have meant. Now, I know it's inconceivable, but I'd like
you to... Will you compare this to a Mexican friend of mine who been a pugilist, a fighter. He made his living by dope smuggling and began to smuggle himself, and then he was going to be a social dope.
Yeah.
And it's a professional pig, which is a low order of crime, the exploitation of women. But this guy's social attitude is quite different. The guy with morality. I would attribute that to one thing, or two things, his background, that he's Mexican, and to the element of motivation, what moves him. The moving and passion in life was that his children shouldn't suffer what he went through as a Mexican.
Right.
And that they would have a better break. He had the advantage of being brought up in a fairly decent home, apparently, with a father who had educated him in Spanish as well as...
Well, you're reflecting a different culture also, you know, reflecting the depravity of capitalism and the Mexican...
But what made the guy capable, you know, of arising above his... environment and his way of making a living, which is criminal.
Mm-hmm.
I would say his family, a devotion to his family, mind you, and his position, social position as a Mexican.
You didn't find this in any of the others, the whites?
Very few of the whites, almost exclusively among Negroes and Mexicans, and some whites. I'll tell you a story about this guy. He became he's a very capable guy. He was appointed the head baker among the inmates. And as such, he's in charge of a crew of half a dozen guys. On his crew, there's two Texans who actually don't want to take anything from a Mexican, considering the period. So he told me the story one day of what happened in the bakery. These two Texans wouldn't work under his supervision. So he said he locked the door from the inside. He took up a rolling pin 3 feet long. He said, okay, come on, let's have it out. Who's boss here? He said, come on, I'm ready. They didn't come. Because at that time on, he was the boss of the bakery. And he told me that story with the greatest pride in his being a Mexican.
Uh-huh.
In the fact that he had won a right, a position that no Mexican had ever had before in that prison. You can't help but admire or have a certain confidence in the moral integrity of the man. There's nothing to do with his criminal record.
These people that you think that you thought were absolutely without any light or moral, what do you think caused that? I mean, did you see anything in their history that you think they were just that kind of people, or what was their history?
That's
I mean, what does make character?
A
is it the society or the
thing? Because well, obviously they're products of society, but that's a long story because they're still individuals. They're still different kinds of people. I would say that the worst kind of people, the most amoral people, were those who were products of the prison system itself.
Uh-huh.
Now you take a lad of, say, 22 years of age who has spent 13 years in prison, who will tell you that he has been outside 3 months in the last 7 years, and doesn't know how to live outside, doesn't know what it's all about. He started as a juvenile delinquent, and he's gone the route from reformatory to federal prison. The word to describe these people is that they're institutionalized. They know no other life than the prison life. They know no morals or ethics or approaches to anything that isn't common to the prison. They're not criminals in the sense of that the...
They're not even people.
people think of a criminal as a, you know, a stealing, conniving guy who's out to pull off some kind of crime. But not criminal. They have no chance to be a criminal. They're in prison.
They're not even people, I don't think, because they've had no social relationships.
They're divorced from society, and they're a product of an institution. That's one type of crime. And most of these people have the earmarks of the training of the institution for 5, 10, 15 years, whatever it is. A lot of these people are from the South. Surprising number. And some of their viciousness and immorality is a reflection of those characteristics that some aspects of Southern culture, if you call it culture. There's one guy who slept in a bunk over me for about 6 months, who was in Florida. And all of the prejudices of the most backward whites in the South. This guy was by profession a pimp. The worst type of living where he's living at this for years. I think the mark of his most amoral attitude is that of his attitude towards them. Ignorant as it's possible to be. Oddly, in prison, I think mainly he learned to be a hospital technician. One human quality I ever found about him was his interest in his qualification, his knowledge as a male nurse or a hospital technician, and the interest that he would sometimes take in helping a patient, or describing it. He pulled some guy through in the hospital through some difficulty. But a brute, a brutal character, in every sense of the word. Very few ordinary human sensibilities.
Do you think such people could ever be regenerated?
What that guy was a product of, I don't know, but I think of the South first. Secondly, of course, is criminal. Really criminal background and habits. And I suspect that the Army had a lot of influence on his death. I don't know in what degree the experiences in the war uprooted many of his social things. This guy had gone through the war, been wounded in the South Pacific. I think he'd probably been a very good soldier. But uprooted from society and becoming an institutionalized character. That's another type. Then there's another character, and this guy really takes the cake for something, I don't know. I call him a delinquent Boy Scout. A real clean-cut American type, 24 years old. You'd think he had grown up in the Boy Scouts as a newspaper route carrier for the local paper, gone to church at the Sunday school every Sunday, and had all the earmarks of having done it and been raised in a good model Texas home. And the kind of lad who, if he went into business, would be an outstanding young man of the year for the Chamber of Commerce in 5 years. All the characteristics, but a petty thief. A small-time criminal and adventurer. Of all the people I'm talking about there, this is probably the guy who could most nearly go straight again because he fit into the environment of the Junior Chamber of Commerce and the local community ideally without changing very much.
He just didn't do it legally.
He told long stories about making a living as an encyclopedia salesman and how he would crown these books down people's throats, and admitting even to being ashamed sometimes of the
high-pressure
salesmanship. music.
But it's
kind of
steel.
A
hold up places?
Automobile cars. Breaking and entering, I suppose. They're petty stuff. Cars. As far as I could make out, he'd stolen cars once and driven up to Alaska where he spent some time adventuring, holidaying in Alaska. Another time he'd gone into Mexico and spent some time down there. To some extent, he was still out for a lark. In other words, no high degree of morality, but the moral outlook and the ethics and the morality is typical to a certain style of petty bourgeois society and acceptable there.
Uh-huh.
But a little outside the law.
He just didn't make a success at it, sorry.
Now, this fellow had a certain intellectual ability. That is, he could learn, and learn quickly, to operate a movie projector, mathematics, reading literature, to a certain degree, studious talk. And with whom I had several long discussions on communism, socialism, what's the difference, and so on and so forth.
Sounds like a brother, I guess. I mean, he's gotten himself a nice little fast job, but he can indulge in all these caprices.
Say the most interesting incident in some ways reflecting if you put social consciousness or something among the people was shortly after Mrs. Roosevelt